It's all right. There's a full bottle.
Lauren was already like, don't drink a bunch with Denny. Fred's like, here you go.
Yep.
Sorry, Lauren.
Yeah, you didn't pour it. You don't
game on.
You don't get to make the rules here.
No, but I'll play along.
This is episode 305 of Bourbon Pursuit, the podcast featuring news, reviews, and interviews with people making the bourbon whiskey industry happen. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Coleman, and before we start today's podcast, talking to our good friend Denny Potter of Maker's Mark, here's your weekly bourbon news update. For the last few years, Buffalo Trace has been hard at work on its $1.2 billion infrastructure investment, some of which includes new barrel warehouses. At a capacity of 58,800 barrels each, the addition of 10 new warehouses has given an on-site barrel inventory of over 1 million aging whiskey barrels. They will continue to add future warehouses at the same size and at a rate of one new warehouse every 4 months. Good friend of the show, David Jennings, who you probably know as Rare Bird 101, recently launched his second Kickstarter campaign for a new book called Wild Turkey Musings. After going through 280 posts that span 5 years of work on his blog, he compiled words that capture his passion for wild turkey, but also provide value for learning and more about the brand. The ebook starts at $15, with the physical book starting at $35, and you can reserve yours now on Kickstarter. Now moving into bourbon release news. Michter's Distillery will begin shipping the 2021 release of its 10-year bourbon. It has been stored in Michter's heat-cycled warehouses and will be bottled at 94.4 proof. It has a suggested retail price of $150. Last week, we had the opportunity to join an in-person tasting and the unveiling of Square 6, the first bourbon to be released by the Evan Williams Bourbon Experience in downtown Louisville. Square 6 designates the original plot of land where Evan Williams built Kentucky's first commercial distillery back in 1783. The Square 6 mash bill consists of 52% corn, 35% rye, and 13% malted barley. Square 6 High Rye Bourbon was aged for 5 years before being bottled at 95 proof, and will have a retail price of $90. Square 6 will also continually change the style of whiskey to be released as more experimentation barrels come of age. Rabbit Hole has a new addition to its high-end Founders collection of whiskeys. It has recently released a 15-year-old cask-strength Kentucky Straight Bourbon finished in Japanese Mizunara oak for 1 year. It's bottled at 114.2 proof. There will only be 1,403 bottles available, and at a suggested retail price of $1,500 per bottle. Step over White Claw because it's time for bourbon to make its way into summer. Jim Beam is launching two ready-to-drink canned cocktails, Jim Beam Classic Highball and the Jim Beam Ginger Highball. These will come in 355-milliliter slender cans at 5% ABV each, and they'll be rolling out nationally at select retailers for $10 for a four-pack. And New Riff is releasing its newest and oldest whiskey yet, a 6-year, 100% malted rye whiskey. There will be a limited amount released this spring in Kentucky, and more to roll out through their distribution network later this year, and has a suggested retail price of $60. And Blue Run Spirits is launching Blue Run 13.5-year-old single barrel cask strength bourbon in 10 separate limited edition bottlings from, well, you guessed it, 10 different barrels. Each is hand numbered to denote the proof, the barrel number, and the bottling date. The modern design by Devin McKinney showcases the brand's signature butterfly medallion, which is a nod to the Kentucky State butterfly, the Viceroy. It's housed in a black lacquer display box made of sustainable birch with an imprinted gold leaf. These will also have a retail price of $230. For today's episode, we have Denny Potter back on the show. You may remember him as the previous master distiller for Heaven Hill, but he's now over at Maker's Mark. We talk about career growth as a master distiller and the decisions that you have to make when figuring out scale while also maintaining consistency. With that, enjoy today's episode. And now here's Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. This week's idea comes from Ron Coulter, who writes me on fredminnick.com. Hi, Fred. On a future episode of Above the Char, I wish you would explain the three-tier system that always comes up on Bourbon Pursuit when you all are talking distribution. Thanks, Ron. You bet, Ron. And unfortunately, I only have a short amount of time here to dedicate to the subject of the three-tier system. It's very complex. It's deeply rooted in our history. And it all comes down to like how our country reacted after Prohibition. So Prohibition ends in 1933, and our government continues to, you know, basically continues to have a lot of temperance moods, and has a lot of belief that alcohol should continue to be regulated, but they didn't want to have like a blanket federal regulation over it outside of like the, you know, Alcohol Administration Act. They wanted the actual governments to come down from like the states. And so they allowed like states to essentially be their own countries. So you had states all over the country creating their own laws. And in some cases, you know, there were really weird laws, like in New York, did not allow women to distill. In Alabama, they created all kinds of laws to prohibit where alcohol could be sold, to include having dry counties. To this day, Kentucky, places like Texas and Tennessee have dry counties. So you still see a lot of those early post-prohibition laws on the books in some places. But it really comes down to the states are, you know, basically if you think of the United States as like one country, and when it comes to alcohol, every state is its own country. And so within that system, the supplier, the distiller, is the first step. That's the first step in the tier. The second step is the distributor. And in every state, the distributor has to have a special license for that state. So a distributor cannot just have one blanket license over the United States without getting approval in every single state. And so that's why when a brand is new to the game, you know, they're like, why can't I just be everywhere? Well, the fact is they have to get a special agreement in Rhode Island, a special agreement in Florida, a special agreement in Texas. So they have to do all of this legwork just to get into one state. So the second tier is the distributor. And the third tier is either the retailer or the bar. And the bylaw, and depending on the state, you know, things are changing rapidly. There's a lot of effort to get rid of a lot of these old laws. But, you know, for the most part, retailers and bars cannot buy directly from the supplier or the distiller. They have to buy from the distributor. But that is changing. And like I had said, there's been a lot of efforts in states to change the laws, but it's happening at state levels. So in Kentucky, you are allowed to buy directly from a distillery, and the bars and retailers are allowed to buy directly from consumers if a product is out of distribution. So there's a lot of things that are changing that are making the world a better place for the consumer to buy rare whiskeys. However, with all of those changes, more complications have come. So the three-tier system, my friends, although I said it was complicated and I did my best here to describe it in a short amount of time, it is not going away at any point, and it's only just getting more complicated by the day. But I appreciate Ron for that question, and I hope that helps answer your curiosity about the three-tier system. But if you want to be like Ron and get your question read on Bourbon Pursuit, be sure to hit me up on fredminnick.com. That's fredminnick.com. And if I like it, I'll read it and do my best to answer the question. That's this week's Above the Char. Be safe out there, everybody. Cheers.
It's that time again to get bourbon strong with Give270. Purchase your $50 tickets for your chance to win from our 50 bourbon prizes. Don't miss out on rare bottles and grand prizes like the legendary Pappy Set, a Weller Rainbow, and the Blood Oath Trilogy. Hurry, only 3,000 tickets are available. Single bottle winners go back in for the grand prize draw. Will you win the ultimate Pappy Set or one of our other incredible prizes? Get your tickets now at Give270.org. Charitable gaming license ORG 000273.
Have you tried to identify specific notes in bourbon when nosing and tasting, but just come up empty? Well, you can train your nose to find all those nuances with a kit from Nose Your Bourbon. And unlike other nosing kits on the market, Nose Your Bourbon kits feature real ingredients for the most authentic aromas. So you can smell real Tahitian vanilla bean instead of some synthetic aroma made from chemicals. Head over to noseyourbourbon.com and enter the code BP10 for 10% off your order. Always find what you love at Total Wine & More. With so many great bottles to choose from at the lowest price, it's easy to find your favorite Cabernet or a new single barrel bourbon to try with some help from one of their friendly guides. And with every bottle comes the confidence of knowing you just found something amazing. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, find what you love and love what you find only at Total Wine & More. Curbside pickup and delivery available in most areas. Visit TotalWine.com to learn more. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly and be 21. From their bar to yours, Chad and Sarah of the popular YouTube channel It's Bourbon Night bring you their favorite at-home old-fashioned mix with the new Elemental Elixirs Golden Hour Syrup. It's a custom-made syrup with notes of bold black tea, warm spices, and orange zest. All you need is your favorite whiskey and ice. No bitters needed. One bottle makes 16 drinks, so that's only $1 a cocktail before you add your own whiskey. They can also be enjoyed in other cocktails or spirits, mocktails, coffee, tea, and anything you can think of. It's crafted locally in Lexington, Kentucky, and you can get your bottle now at whiskeyambitions.com. It's that time of the year where everybody's starting to make their vacation plans on visiting Kentucky, the mecca of bourbon. And if you are coming to Kentucky, you need to make sure you visit us at Pursuit Spirits in Louisville. We're right in the heart of Clifton, near Butchertown and Nulu, and only just a few miles away from downtown Louisville. But when you do come, you need to book your experience to go do our whole shebang. This is the one that's really the star of the show. You get a full-on tasting, you get to do your own personal barrel selection experience, and you get to grab a whiskey thief and fill your bottle directly from the barrel. We're doing something completely brand new that nobody else is doing here in bourbon country. Plus, you get a free sweet tasting glass at the end of it. I guarantee you, you're going to end up being one of the many people that's also leaving us a 5-star review. So make sure you come and check us out. You can book your reservation by going to pursuitspirits.com and clicking the Visit Us button. Welcome back to the episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. The whole gang here today talking about Maker's Mark. And more importantly, the man that has been on the show, last time he was on was back in 2017. So we're looking at 3+ years now since he's been
that long.
Wow.
Time flies.
I know.
Yeah. And he was with someone else back then, too.
I know. We're going to get some juicy inside scoop.
Oh,
maybe.
I know.
He's going to ditch out all the shit. Why'd I come here?
Ditch out all.
I knew what I was getting into.
Yeah.
You guys don't shock me anymore.
Yeah. That's why he brought bourbon.
I know. And you've heard his voice already, but, you know, Denny Potter is a good friend of the show. He's a good friend to all of us here. And it's good to be able to have him come on. And we've talked about his past and his story back on episode 108, and we're almost up to like episode 300 now. So it's been a while. So if you've never heard his history, you can go back to episode 108. And that was back when he was at his former company. We'll kind of talk about progression and career and everything like that. And so any kind of color commentary before we kind of kick this off, guys?
Well, Denny to me is like, is the best like interview in bourbon. When you want to talk like science and everything, because he has like a really great way of breaking things down for anybody. And so he also is very transparent. So even if he's got the little thumb of a company over him saying he can't say something, he'll say it anyway for you.
Yeah, and they're not here today.
Yeah, that's right.
Save him from himself.
Yeah. So.
Somehow we got through the PR mess and just got him here on his own.
Yeah.
Listen, if they don't know what a mess I am by now, then that's probably their
yeah. Right. Andy's got one of the best pedigrees in bourbon. Gosh, he's been to all the best major players, you know. So he's got he's got like all the banners, you know, in his gym, you know.
And he's a huge music fan too. I remember meeting his parents and talking music. You know, we were at we were at Whiskey Fest or Whiskey Live or some fest. I don't remember. New Orleans. It was New Orleans.
Oh, yeah. So,
and I was just hanging out with his parents, and we were all talking about music. And so anytime I get to talk about, you know, like Tears for Fears or something like that with somebody, it's just cool.
Just jives.
Love it.
Yeah. So you've heard his voice. We talked about it enough. So, of course, Denny Potter, master distiller at Maker's Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Kenny. Good to be back.
Yeah.
I can't believe it's 2017. That's
Man, back in the good old days.
Going on 4 years.
I know.
Back when I could find Pappy.
I don't even know if you could find Pappy back then. So let's go ahead and let's just dive into this then. So let's kind of talk about the progression. We all kind of know that you came from Heaven Hill. You have, as Ryan alluded, a strong pedigree and background. And I kind of want to, you know, put all on the table first. Like, what was the culminating kind of choice that made you want to move from, you know, Heaven Hill and kind of switching teams? We were kind of talking about before this show started. It seems like if you get to this level, it's almost like trading NFL players at this point. Right. Like you're at the top of your game. So kind of talk about what that was like.
Yeah, I mean, and I think to explain, you know, how I got to that point to make that decision, you got to really start with, you know, where I started. You know, it's, I know that I've worked at a lot of different plants, but I've really only been with two companies. One being the company I'm with now, which, you know, obviously is Maker's Mark. It's my second stint at Maker's, but Maker's is obviously a part of Beam Suntory, which is a, you know, a larger organization. So, you know, in 1998, in January of 98 is when I started out at Jim Beam. I started out at Claremont, which was, you know, the one thing about like my career that I've been extremely fortunate is the people that I've been able to work with, you know, directly in operations. So it all started back then. You know, I started out in the lab at Beam, at Claremont, and then, you know, moved over to Maker's in 2003, which, you know, obviously we're all owned by the same parent company. And then, you know, when I was at Maker's for 7 years, and when I was with Maker's, you know, our parent company bought the rum distillery, which you guys have heard this story before, bought Cruisin' Rum down in St. Croix. Well, they had asked me to go run that operation for 3 years as general manager. And the whole caveat to that was, you know, I was assistant master distiller at Maker's at the time, director of distillery and environmental operations. So I had a great job, had a great path to be plant manager there, which, you know, is kind of the job that I have now. And, you know, so the whole idea of going down to Cruisin' was I just wanted to learn, you know, I didn't know much about rum, didn't know much, you know, about the process, and in particular, didn't know much about the culture. And then, you know, let's face it, it's in the Virgin Islands. So, you know, to have an opportunity like that, but the whole idea was I was coming back to Maker's. It was 3 years. I mean, trust me, if this wasn't an assignment and it was open-ended, I don't know that I would have done it. I don't know that my wife would have allowed me to do it, you know, because that's just a big change for, you know, your family, your kids. So when the assignment was up, I got shipped to another Beam facility. So it wasn't Maker's. And, you know, that I went to Jim Beam Frankfurt, which is a great place. I mean, it's the old granddad facility and all that, but they hadn't distilled there in years. And it's 100% a bottling operation. And so, you know, they asked for my help to go there to run the plant because, you know, we had closed the Jim Beam Cincinnati plant, which had been in operation. We had bought Pinnacle Vodka. So we were moving all that production down from White Rock Distillers into the Jim Beam Frankfurt plant. And the whole plan was I was just going to be there a year. They're like, listen, this transition's going on, all hands on deck. We'd love to have you there. We moved right back into our house in Bardstown because we didn't sell it because we knew it was an assignment going to the Virgin Islands. So I was driving back and forth from Bardstown to Frankfurt. And even though it was only supposed to be a year, about 7 months into it, they were, man, we might want to make this longer than that. And so the feeling that I had then was I'm no longer in control of my career, right? Mm-hmm. Loved Frankfurt, loved the operation, loved the people, and struggled with the fact that it didn't have a distillery. I just did. I mean, that's, you know, kind of what I grew up with and where a lot of my passion was. So it just so happened, you know, like that 7 months into the Frankfurt, I got contacted by a recruiter for Heaven Hill. And this was at a time when, you know, obviously Parker had been diagnosed with ALS. Craig was involved, but Craig was going to be doing a little bit more, you know, Craig Beam, a little bit more travel on that side. Plus Craig had a trucking company and he wanted to focus on that. So they asked me to come in as plant manager to run the Bernheim operation down at, you know, down in West Louisville. And so I did. I'm like, I've got, you know, I need to be back at a distillery and I've got to feel like I'm back in control of my career. You know, somebody else isn't telling me what my next opportunity is. So I did. So in 2013 is when I moved over to Heaven Hill as the plant manager of the Bernheim operation. It was really kind of the first time I got to know Fred pretty well because, you know, Fred was doing a lot of research, came to that. I mean, it's a phenomenal distillery. I mean, it's a shame that, you know, it's not on the Bourbon Trail. Maybe someday They'll be able to do that.
It's a massive, impressive like operation.
Industrial powerhouse.
Well, and did you help with the expansion too?
The expansion was definitely my project. And so that's where we did the podcast, right?
Right.
Didn't you guys come? Yeah, you guys came to Bernheim back then. So, and then, you know, it's also one of those things where when you're in an opportunity like that, like make the best of it, right? So it just, you know, unfortunately, you know, Parker with ALS was unable to do any travel or anything like that. And that's where the Shapira family came and said, hey, listen, we'd love for you to take on a role as master distiller, you know, for a lot of the marketing stuff. And let's face it, and I've talked about it before, the title master distiller is phenomenal, right? I mean, it's something that when somebody asks you to do that, or, you know, they give you that title, there's a lot of pride involved in that. But the reality is the bulk of that title is marketing related. It gives you credibility to go out and talk about what we do and how we do it. And people are genuinely interested. You know, if I just came out, I mean, my other title is plant manager. Well, plant manager doesn't have the same pull as master
not
distiller.
Sexy. Like a chemical plant, like rat poison or something.
Yeah, right. I mean, it could go any direction. So, you know, that's when I took on a role as master distiller with Heaven Hill. And then internally, I actually got another promotion, which was as vice president of operations over all the production facilities, because obviously Heaven Hill does more than just whiskey, and was a part of the executive leadership team with the Shapira family. So it was great. You're right. I mean, it was an unbelievable opportunity, and I was enjoying the hell out of it. And it just, you know, it was the summer of 18. I got kind of a nondescript text from Rob Samuels, and I'd worked with Rob, but I really had worked more with Bill when I left to go to Cruisin', which was 2010. And so, you know, I didn't know Rob that well. And he was like, hey, you know, just would love to talk and catch up. And so in conversations with Rob, that's where he's like, hey, listen, man, you know, we'd love for you to come back to Maker's Mark, not just as master distiller, but also plant manager. Because to me, it's, you know, if without the plant manager role, I don't know that I would take the master distiller role. But I also understand how important that role is, right? So, you know, Rob and I did a lot of talking about coming back. And the one thing about Makers, the day-to-day at Makers, you know, outside of the brand is phenomenal. I mean, you know, the people that we have there, it is a community. I mean, the bulk of our employees, all of our employees are from Marion County. The bulk are from Loretto, which is a town of 400. We have 240 employees. So, you know, we have a lot of families, you know, generational that have worked at Makers or do work at Makers. And then a lot of the things that we were doing before I left that I always thought would be pressure tested as you grew, that, you know, if you're going to bastardize how you do things because you've let the accountants in the room, these things would have changed. You know, whether that's going from roller mill to hammer mill, whether that's a larger batch size, whether that's going in the barrel at 125 instead of 110 like we do, whether that's stopping barrel rotation, but in particular, hand dipping bottles. And, you know, it was one of those things. I'm like, well, if they, you know, the finance guys have taken over, then those are the things you can look at. And so in 2018, I was just looking at the volume numbers, and what I quickly calculated was, shit, they hand dipped 25 million bottles last year, because we were still hand dipping, obviously. And so it was all those things. And as I think about, you know, finishing out my career over the next, who knows, 10 to 20 years, I love the day to day. I love it. I mean, I love, you know, pulling in the parking lot. You know, that site is just a super beautiful, special site. And then just to be able to walk through the facility, and I mean, everybody, whether they drink Makers or not, all the employees there are all in. And let's face it, I mean, it's a great place to work. I mean, there's not a bad job in our industry. There's not. Heaven Hill was phenomenal. Makers is phenomenal. You name all the others. I mean, we're the luckiest people in the world to be a part of this industry. And Makers is just one of those that I care about the day-to-day. And the day-to-day there is just, it's weird to be at a place where you could be in a shitty mood, right? Driving into work that day or whatever. But I mean, it's one of those things that as soon as I get there, I'm like, oh shit, this is great. Mm-hmm. Whereas there's a lot of jobs, it's the exact opposite. You know, you get out of your vehicle, you're like, God damn, I can't wait till 6 o'clock. I mean, it's the exact opposite. So it wasn't necessarily that I wanted to leave Heaven Hill. I think it was just the opportunity to come back, knowing that I could somewhat finish, you know, where I had started in the role that I have. And trust me, man, there's not a day goes by that I don't miss Heaven Hill. Mm-hmm. I do miss it. I miss the people, phenomenal brands, right? You look at their whiskey portfolio and everything that they do, they're family owned. I mean, there's not, trust me, and there are a lot of people look at me and go like, what the shit were you thinking? Man? How could you leave a company like that? And it's just that, you know, I've just always felt kind of this bond with Makers and just what we do there and the people there. It really is, you know, about the people, because at the end of the day, we're all manufacturing sites. It can be glamorous, it can be everything else because of the distilleries, but we do run 7 days a week, 24 hours a day in the distillery, like a lot of factories do. The bottling line, it's a bottling line, right? I mean, it's the part of the operation nobody wants to talk about because it's not as glamorous, but at the end of the day, I mean, it's a big part of what we do. And to watch people, I mean, I know it sounds like I'm kind of summing everything up just to one little example, but I think the dipping the bottles is a huge one, because the people that run the lines, when they're dipping bottles, it's not like we're running the line slow. I mean, these lines are running 150 bottles a minute. So each dipper's dipping one bottle every 5 seconds. That's phenomenal, right? I mean, can you imagine? And then, I mean, there's pressure to that too, because God damn it, you got to finish this one up because there's one right behind
it. Don't slow up the line.
But they're doing it and they're smiling, they're laughing, they're talking. Visitors come in, they'll engage with them. It's just, it's very unique. And so, you know, I don't know if it really was never about leaving Heaven Hill. It really was about going back to Makers and just thinking about the next, you know, 10 to 20 years. So I don't know if that fully answers the question. Up, but
I think it definitely does. I would imagine because traveling is a part of this role and stuff like that. And I know when, you know, my wife worked at Heaven Hill, they say like, Heaven Hill, what is, when you talk to actually regular common folk, like, what is Heaven Hill? And you have to like explain like, oh, these are the brands. They're like, I get it. But now you're like, oh, Maker's Mark. You're like, oh, absolutely. Everybody knows.
Yeah, the Red Wax. Makers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. And, you know, and what would the cool thing about Heaven Hill, you know, the last couple of years there was that real push to, man, let's be proud of our name, right? The Heaven Hill name. Because most people, when they would think about Heaven Hill, they think about, I mean, like I did back in college, I drank the hell out of 175 Heaven Hill vodka, right? Because it's like $7. And so when people were thinking about Heaven Hill, they were thinking about, you know, a lot of the value stuff. But when you looked at like the whiskeys that they were putting out, not just the ones that everybody knows, whether it's Evan Williams, Elijah Craig, those, but like the Heaven Hill whiskeys that they were putting out, whether it was the white label, the green label, they were phenomenal. But you're right.
Yeah. And it's just the connotation just wasn't there for a lot of people.
So it sounded like maybe Rob, well, obviously with the growth of whiskey and like they could kind of see like, all right, we have a good thing going, but we really need to put some gasoline and we need somebody that can help control this fire to get us to that after we pour this gasoline on.
Well, there's also Greg. Greg was, you know, he was a great master distiller at Makers, and you know, he moved on over to the Booker's gig. So what happened first? Did he take a position there, and they were looking to fulfill that?
Yeah, Greg was offered the opportunity to move to the Beam side of the business, and they've got, you know, obviously the two distilleries with Claremont and Booker. No, and I think Greg, you know, Greg was looking, you know, just to kind of expand, you know, his, what he was responsible for, but also to learn a little bit too. And, you know, Greg and Fred and Freddie were, you know, really good friends. And I think, you know, I just think it was a, you know, an opportunity for Greg to do that. So yeah, that was not me coming in and Greg leaving. That was literally Greg wanted to pretty much kind of move on and move up and take on a little bit more. And Greg's great. I've known Greg forever. I was at Greg's house, not last night, the night before. And I think he loves it over there, especially working with Fred and Freddie. And you know,
man, I can just see that trio to get together and drinking. Yeah, Greg can hit. He can put them down.
Greg enjoys putting them down. I enjoy putting them down with Greg.
Yeah. He's hard to keep up with.
It is. It's a good crew, man. It's a really good crew.
So I guess another question about just career path and career growth and transitioning. Did you ever think to the point where, like, when you're at Heaven Hill at being the master distiller there, like, this is it. Like, there's really nowhere else to go from here. I mean, do you feel like coming back now here to Maker's Mark? Are you like, okay, like, maybe this is it. Like, at some point, I think it must be hard for somebody going through trying to, you know, tread their career path, trying to be a distiller, to work their way at the master distiller. There's got to be a ceiling somewhere.
Listen, from the distillery side, if master distiller is not the ceiling, I don't know what is, and I wouldn't want what is. But you're absolutely right, Kenny. I mean, it was an interesting, you know, when I sat in a room with Max Shapira and Alan Latz, which is his son-in-law, and Alan runs, you know, he was COO, and they asked me to, you know, take on the role as master distiller. Like, within the first couple minutes, that was the exact conversation we had. I'm like, listen, this is a great opportunity. I love it. But what does that mean as far as growth? within the operation. And they were like, well, this is, you know, don't worry about that. Like, this is, you know, you're obviously, you know, distilleries, you run the distillery, you're doing all that work. We know that you've got this covered, but don't think that that's going to stunt anything on the operation side. And they were true to their word because, you know, it was probably about a year later is when, you know, they promoted me to vice president of operations, which was over, you know, all the operations for Heaven Hill, not just, you know, the Bernheim distillery. So now from there, yeah, it's pretty much kept. I mean, when you're reporting into the family and it's, you know, a company that's been owned and operated by a family for 85 years.
And the first non-Beam to hold the title.
Yeah. No, that's a bit, I mean, trust me, you know, when I think back about, you know, proudest points in my career, it has to be that. It's because of they, you know, they asked me to do it, right? Mm. And not only that, but they asked me to do it in the footsteps of Parker and working with Craig. And yeah, I mean, you can't help but, you know, kind of get caught up in that. And that was a huge, huge, huge deal for me. But I think you also realize too that, you know, do you have to be focused on the next big thing? I think for me, that's come with age a little bit. Am I capped right now? I mean, I report into Rob Samuels. I mean, potentially, but it's not, I mean, you know, if I were to retire today, I'd be happy.
And there would be the old Potter distillery coming out here.
Consulting.
Yeah, right. I mean, you get, and trust me, you do get a lot of feelers, you know, about people wanting, you know, seeing if you're interested about starting your own distillery.
Oh, really? So people reach out to you all the time to
Yeah. I mean, it's, it probably at least 4 or 5 times a year, I'd say. I mean, it's, you know, you have people that, you know, that have the money to back, but, you know, don't necessarily have the experience or expertise to do it. And it is, it's fascinating. I mean, I would never say it's not, I would never say it's not anything you just brush to the side and not think about. For me, I don't know. I mean, I just really like being a part of something that's been around since 1954. And then, you know, when you see the impact that the brand has just locally for the community, because they're very, very good paying jobs. You know, we're in an area of Kentucky where the cost of living isn't that high. So you see how people can live and you know, how their family can come on board. And then, I don't know. I mean, I see both sides of it. Trust me, I do see both sides of it. But, you know, just having what I have at Makers, that's kind of what you aspire to be. So if you've got it, and I know it's not my name on the bottle, but I've never been about that. Like I love, obviously, you know, I want everything to do with the liquid, the quality of the liquid, how people respond to the liquid. But, you know, as far as having my name on the liquid, it's never been something that, you know, I've really thought too much about.
You have a Potter's fave at some point.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe there's slight
Potter's. It's going to have to be a decanter, like a pot. You know, some type, but I wanted to, you know, talk to you about, like, I've in watching Rob, like, come in and take over for his father and, you know, seeing how he's managed the company. I have to say, man, I am so proud of him and how good of a job he has done. What's it been like, you know, working with Rob? Cause he's the first couple years he was in his father's shadow. Now Rob is his own man for sure, and everybody in Beansumatore knows it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that has been, yeah, that was one of the interesting things coming back, because, you know, as I said, I had primarily worked for Bill, and Rob was involved in the business, but it's a little more on the commercial side, right? I mean, just cutting his teeth on that side, do it the right way to do it, you know, instead of just coming in and, you know, you're 30 years old and they hand you the reins. No, it was literally do this, do this, do this, and Rob did all those things, and they're two different people.
Yeah.
But with the same ambition and the same goals, they go about it differently. Rob is, you know, just Rob is a thinker. He sits back a little bit. Anybody that's ever been around Bill or worked for Bill, Bill's, you know, just somebody that's Bill's going to tell you exactly what's on his mind, right? And yeah, so
he seems like more of a dreamer, a visionary like type, and Rob kind of is more like analytical. You know, like let's think about it.
I think that's a good way to put it, and I do think that. Yeah, I mean, he's all in, and I think he's adapted his style. I mean, there's no way you can't, just like, you know, me at Heaven Hill with Parker or anything like that. I mean, it's impossible. You can't, you know, he can't fill Bill's shoes, but he doesn't need to, right? Like, he's cutting his own path, and it's a different business. Yeah. I mean, as you guys know, I mean, just the change over the last 10 years has been phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I think Rob has
Begging people to come visit you to, like, all right, how do we manage these people visiting us? Just, and how do we
I mean, I joke about, you know, even when I was assistant master distiller back in Makers, you know, around 2007, 2008, 2009. I mean, you know, our bourbon educations and tastings, I'd spend 30 minutes explaining to people the rules of bourbon. And they would blow their minds when I'd say, you know, it doesn't have to be made in Kentucky.
Bullshit. Get out of here. Lying to me. That can't be true.
It's like, no. If I couldn't tell you the last time I really talked about the rules of bourbon. If I were to start out an education or a tasting explaining the rules of bourbon, I'd fully expect somebody to come up, punch me in the face and be like, man, don't insult our intelligence, right?
I want to know about the dry yeast versus propagated yeast, bro.
Yeah. Right. No, and that's true. That is. I mean, that is the level of engagement you get now. And it's, I love it. I mean, you know, anymore, especially over the last year, because we've had to turn to so many things virtually, I would much rather show up and just be like, all right, let's open it up for questions and just go with that. And honestly, that is a lot of what I do now. You know, you might come with about 10 minutes of what you think you want to cover and then just let people go, because when people have a genuine interest and fascination in what we do, and you're trying to be transparent about it, makes it easy. Like, I don't know why there's so many, I don't know that it exists anymore, but there was a time that if you asked somebody what their mash bill was, they'd be, oh my God, how dare you?
Pretty sure you're still trying to get it out of the beams over there.
Yeah, beam and wild turkey still.
And nectars.
And yeah. They all have their reasons. I just, you know, there's so many variables involved into making whiskey, and the mash bill is a part of that. And Fred and I have talked about this before. Just you take all those variables and you multiply them together and you're like, man, okay, it plays a part. But if somebody wants to take our mash bill and try and go make our style of whiskey, go for it. Shit, call me up. I'll give you pointers throughout the way. But there are so many things that have to be identical.
It's near
impossible.
Speaking of questions, I had a question about yourself. So what do you think it is about yourself? Like, what qualities or what like tactics do you have as a master distiller that makes you attractable, you know, to these big names? Like, what do you think that you add to the table at Maker's Mark? Or
is this a job?
Like,
are you interviewing him right now?
I am.
Are you
going to ask me to start a distillery?
Well,
after this?
I guess where I'm coming from that is, like, most people think, all right, they think distiller, okay, he must make the whiskey and must taste it. Whereas there's this whole other, and maybe you can lead into that. My other question is talk about the people that make up a master distiller too, but everything that else is not just making and tasting the whiskey.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a great point. And it is something I go out of my way to try to explain when we're talking about the master distiller role itself. You know, so, you know, the one thing, you know, with the title, right, master distiller, I look at my number one job. Well, actually there's two. One is to educate. You know, that is just something that comes with it. And I'm okay with that. If you told me coming out of college that I would be, you know, sitting in front of 300 people talking about what I do or how we do things, I'd be like, man, that sounds miserable. but you kind of understand why it's necessary and people are genuinely interested. But the role master distiller for me is, from a production standpoint, is protecting the quality of the whiskey and then making sure, you know, especially in an operation like ours, when you're running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that the people in the distillery have the tools and everything that they need to do the job that they can do. The reality is, you know, I believe we've got 18, you know, operators in our distillery. They're all master distillers. I mean, they all can run every job. They can run the mill, the mash tub, the still. They can do, you know, all the work required for fermentation. You know, maybe they don't want to get out in front and talk about it, but they're true master distillers. And that's what I tell some of these people that come asking about, you know, starting a new distillery. I'm like, man, I can help you. I certainly can. But I mean, we've got 18 people that probably be good at that. So, you know, it's just, there's so many people involved and, you know, can I sit at the table? Yes. I mean, I think one of the important things is that the title is based in operations. I think that's important. I think probably a lot of the people you all have talked to and built relationships with are people that, whether they have the title or don't have the title, are rooted in operations. One, because the knowledge base is there, but two, because it's, you know, there's a real passion.
How long should someone be in the kind of operations role before they take that title, master distiller?
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. And with Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner
that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. And you can get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/bourbon, all lowercase, and go to shopify.com/bourbon to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/bourbon. If you're anything like me, then you can't get enough about bourbon. And that's why I'm a subscriber to Bourbon Plus magazine. Bourbon Plus is a quarterly publication that tells the stories from the heart of bourbon, the farmers who grow the grain, the distillers who labor over the process, and the people, like you and me, who raise their glasses to celebrate it all. Subscribe to Bourbon Plus magazine today at bourbonplus.com, that's P-L-U-S.com, and use code PURSUIT at checkout for $5 off your subscription.
How long should someone be in the kind of operations role before they take that title, master distiller?
Man, that's a tough one, Fred. I mean, it's, I mean, you know, I think it's when someone deems you ready, whether that's somebody within your own company that started the brand, you know, that has hired you for that. You know, I know people have talked about there needs to be a, you know, some type of certification, and I don't know that I necessarily agree with that, because there are other things involved. For me, I think it's, you know, just come in willing to learn, engage, reach out. I mean, we all love to talk about what we do. We all love to share things that we see in operations, and whether or not there's commonality, if we're having issues, because, you know, some of us source, like when you're talking malt and things like that, a lot of times they come from the same operation. So if you're having an issue, hell shit, somebody else might be having the same issue. So why not engage with that? But Fred, it's a good question. I don't think it's a title you ever give to yourself. If it's a title you've given to yourself, I don't know how genuine that is. But if it's a title that's kind of bestowed upon you, or somebody says, you know what, this is important, and maybe it's not rooted in operations. Maybe it is about telling the story and, you know, just being out, you know, consumer facing, public facing, and they're ready. I think that's, do I think the title's been watered down? Absolutely. I do. I mean, I just think that, you know, there are people that have the title that don't have distilleries. That's a little difficult to me. If you're going to have the title as master distiller, you should at least have a distillery. But
now, in their defense, they're bottling the exact same recipe as their great, great grandpa that happens to be the same as MGP ingredients. I mean, so
that 95.5 is pretty prolific.
It's in their blood.
A lot of grandparents with that
in their
recipe.
Blood.
It is. And listen, I mean, and I, you know, I would never, I mean, they, in all of those brands and the way that they do it and sourcing and all that has been super important. I mean, right? They're, you know, Makers doesn't grow at the rate that we grew at if it's not things like that that have drawn more people into, you know, whether it's bourbon, but American whiskey. I mean, I think it's super important, you know, how we've gotten here, and it's all related. And
we're, and of course, you all have a 12 or 15 year old bottled and bond coming out later this year, right?
Oh, Fred.
Well, I'll distract you from that question.
No, it's not. Fred's been asking the long time. Trust me, it would be good.
I mean, seriously, if you all would just put out like something 12 years old or older, I know it used to be in your overage tasting, it would win every damn award there is. And
you're right.
I mean, when I had Bill Samuels, this is where all this comes from. Bill Samuels.
I don't know that I've heard this direct from you. I'm interested to hear your story.
All right. So Bill Samuels comes on does the Legend series with me at the Kentucky Derby Museum. And we were actually having problems selling tickets. It's kind of weird. Like it was the time of year or something. And he said, all right, I've got something. I know what to do. He's like, we'll bottle up some 12-year-old that we have, and that'll help sell some tickets. And then we go on some TV stations talking about, he's like, yeah, we're going to be tasting 12-year-old Maker's Mark. Tickets sold out like immediately. We get in the crowd, we do this taste up, and he's like talking down the 12-year-old like it's not any good. I said, Bill, you're wrong. This stuff is great. And I asked the crowd, I was like, all right, let's vote. Who likes the, you know, the standard Maker's Mark? You know, everyone loves. I was like, do you like the Maker's 12-year-old more? Every hand went up. He's like, and Bill goes like, you guys are like fucking crazy. He said something
you're,
like
you're
that.
Just wrong.
Yeah.
It's awesome that he brought it. I didn't realize he did that.
Yeah, that's so good. It's all his fault, not mine.
So that makes me think of a question about Makers and someone in the operations, you know, someone who's fanatic about operations. It seems like a company like Makers would be like an operations man's like dream because it's all about consistency. How can we refine it to like perfection? You know, it's make the same recipe, same, don't mess it up. And maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things that I get asked, especially leaving Heaven Hill and coming back to Makers, which is, you know, obviously, Heaven Hill has a lot of different expressions. We ran five primary mash bills that led to a lot of great whiskeys, right? There's the thing with Makers for me, there's a lot of that and it's awesome. And we do some of it, right? You know, whether it's our wood finishing series, whether it was the evolution of Private Select, whether it's, you know, there's just a lot of different things, but man alive. I mean, I take great pride and I get a lot of fulfillment out of making sure we're still doing things the same way, right? Since 1954, for the most part, when we did our first barrel. I love that. I love the idea of protecting the heritage and the legacy because, I mean, let's just say some of that changed, right? One, it, you know, probably not good for the brand, but do I want to be proud about 15 years from now, somebody says, oh, well, what if we went back to doing this? And I'll say, oh, that's awesome. That's great. Well, I mean, you know, let's keep doing what we're doing. Maybe we don't get huge credit for that, because it's not a big talking point. But at the end of the day, I think all of that is super important. And I love the fact that we are still doing things pretty much the same way since we did that first barrel and even did the first bottle in 58, 59 when we did that first bottle that was hand-dipped. If you've seen, I know, Fred, you've seen the very first bottle of Makers, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks almost identical to the bottle that we do today. So even from a package standpoint, it's very similar.
What are the challenges of trying to keep that integrity when you're trying to meet the demand and scale it at the point that it is now?
It's the main reason why we don't have a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
Right? Because, you know, classic Makers.
Way to go, Fred. There's your answer.
No, it is, but
I mean, blame you and consumer demand.
But it's a real thing. I mean, you know, classic Makers on average is anywhere between, you know, we're 5 year, 9 months. And right now we're dumping some barrels that are probably about 7.5 years old. So you're right. And I mean, we, you know, Makers, the brand has been on allocation for years. We don't export much. You know, the bulk of our market is still in the US. And so it's a, you know, when those things, we know, like, listen, I mean, I know 12-year-old Makers would be good. I would never say it was bad. Is it different than, you know, what we're used to in our taste? Sure it is, but doesn't mean it's bad. It's just different. But to set those things aside means you're pulling back, you know, some of the classic. And it was a lot of the things we got into at Heaven Hill too, because, you know, you had one mash bill that would fuel probably six different ages. Right. And you always had to play, you know, make those decisions of, okay, this, they all tasted different, but they were all the same mash bill. So it's, you know, I enjoy that part of it. You know, we are trying to scale up. I mean, we're still, you know, the number three bourbon in the world. Not that we care about that, but that's, you know, that's a pretty big deal. And it's just making sure as we grow the right way. And I think that's the key. And I think we have, you know, it's probably only been in the last, you know, when I left to go to Cruzan, I was obviously intimately involved in coming up with Makers 46. And that was myself, Kevin Smith, who was master distiller at the time. I was assistant master distiller, and Bill. And that's when, I mean, for 55 years, we'd only done one thing. And then all of a sudden Bill shows up and all I'd ever heard is, you know, don't fuck up my parents' whiskey. That's all you ever heard. And he was right, because we sold every drop. It's all on allocation. So when Bill came and said that, you know, he wanted to kind of create his own version of Makers and his taste vision, and that led to pretty much where we are today with wood finishing, I think it has kind of changed our philosophy a little bit of, this is the only thing we do and this is how we do it. But at the same time, as we do these other things, they'll always be kind of done in the spirit of Makers. So I think we've come a long way. We have, you know, I know Fred knows Jane, and you guys probably know Jane Bowie, but Jane's really been leading our innovation. She pretty much created with Rob the Private Select program and all the other things. And we finally have an innovation department. So that's big for us, spearheaded by Jane.
Yeah, you took down the old tagline of "We are rooted in stubborn tradition."
We have, and it's fun and it's interesting, and it's, you know, it's led to, you know, things like,
yeah, the private selection is so much fun for a barrel pick. If anyone hasn't done it, it's because you get to make your own, basically your own maker's blend with different finishing states.
The only problem with it is I keep tasting ones, like, damn it, I wish I had done that one.
It's funny, you go in there and you have like, all right, I'm going to make something that's unique and it's going to be this. And then you start and you're like, well, wait a minute, let me see what other people have done. And then you start going off that and seeing what people that had something that was successful versus trying to make this like bold mocha, you know, makers or whatever.
Do you have a favorite private select?
You know what's funny was when I first came back, you know, I knew the private select program, but I didn't really fully understand what it was.
It is a difficult thing to explain to people.
It's very tactile. Like, you almost have to go through it, but it's like a chemistry experiment as you sit
and you have to allocate like 8 hours for the day.
A lot of drinking. There's a lot of sampling and a lot of drinking.
I like that one.
So there's kind of one is I love what we call the Bill Samuels Jr. Private Select, which is basically 46 cask. So, you know, the Private Select was born out of, you know, everything we learned creating Makers 46. And, you know, that's where they use the 10 French oak stave. So that's part of the combination you can use to build private select. So when they asked Bill what private select barrel he wanted, he just said, I just want 1046 staves at cast strength. So that's kind of my favorite, but I'm a big fan. I love the P2 stave. It's the only American oak stave in the combination. And I think, you know, if anybody had the 2020 wood finishing series, that was a little take of American oak with heavy vanilla. I just love the heavy vanilla that comes out of that. Mm-hmm. Never been a big fan of the mocha stave, and that's the most popular stave, which we are retiring that stave. That stave's going away.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. So that's going away this year.
Why?
Because it's the most popular stave.
Everybody loves it. Well, let's get rid of it. I know the new maker's philosophy. For a loop. Yeah. You want 12-year-old? Never going to happen. You suck. Like the mocha stave?
It's gone.
You find something you like, it's out.
Well, it's...
Yeah, y'all keep talking about it. We're just going to take it away.
The caveat to that is, if you've built a barrel with us and you use the mocha stave, you will always have access to it. So it's not going away fully. So if you've built a barrel, any new barrel will
entice people to create new expression.
Now everyone's going to be coming in there. Here's $100. I know you heard about this stave.
Now the mocha stave barrels are going to be worth more.
It's a good, I mean, listen, I think a lot of it is, I mean, you guys are good tasters. A lot of people, they're very influential when you're tasting, right? I mean, it's just because you get... What happens when people do barrel selections, and specifically private select, they end up bringing people with them that just want to experience. Like, it's such a fun experience. They may not taste a lot of whiskey, right? So I think people would see, oh, they got a mocha stave. Ooh, that sounds good. Yeah. It's a good, trust me, it's a good stave. It's a bit of a dry chocolate. For me, it has a dry finish to it. And I like creamy. Like, I just like a creamy kind of finish. Yeah. But you can, I mean, you know, you can use that mocha stave in combination to create a lot of different things, but that mocha stave.
It is creamy, but kind of makes it like taste like a dusty, like almost like a butterscotch. I'm trying to remember which stave that
probably
was.
Cuvée.
That's it. Yeah. I remember I was like, I'm going to make like 10 cuvées.
Yeah.
It didn't translate, but it was good.
Yeah. People have done that. You know, people have done that.
I kind of want to do like a taste off now, like get all of the private selects and like.
We have a couple here somewhere.
There's a lot to go through though.
I know. There's so many.
I will do it for America.
That's going to be a long YouTube series.
I can take tomorrow off. I mean,
I'm on glass 572.
We'll just post up in the library there because they're all sitting there, right?
We are most of 14-hour podcast.
No breaks.
We're live streaming here.
And we're only 3% of the way through.
Can't wait till Lauren edits that one. She'll really love us.
You know, as we kind of like round this down a little bit.
Is it time to wrap up?
We're getting close here. We're going to, I know. The hour flies by. It really does. You know, I kind of want to bring it back into your role of moving back over. Mm-hmm. And what was it like either re-onboarding or when you came back, you're like, it's exactly as I remember.
Yeah,
it's like
old locker there.
The old locker, you know, went to that wall. He, you know, drew his height on the board. And he's like, that's where I was.
Hell, he's got shorter. What the heck? Gained some weight. Man, good question. I mean, it's, it really was like coming home. Different because we had a lot more people. And, you know, when I left to go to Corrusion, we had 80 employees. So when I came back in 2018, we had about 230 employees. So it was, you quickly go from knowing everybody to, oh my God, I don't know anybody. But then you talk to them, they're like, oh, I'm so-and-so's kids. Like, oh yeah, okay, right, yeah. So different, but the same. Different in that, you know, it's hard. Like I like to be out in the operation. I like to talk to people. It's not as easy to, you know, like we would have our Christmas party at Mordecai's in Lebanon.
Oh yeah.
Right. Love so that. Not a big place. Well, we can't have our Christmas party at Mordecai's in Lebanon anymore. So it's things like that, or I'm sorry, Springfield, not Lebanon. It's just things like that. Like, how do you get the people together? You know, how can you literally be out in the plant, be front facing, get to know everybody on a personal level? That's what becomes hard. That's what's different, is, you know, really trying to build relationships with people at the plant. And just because we have, you know, we do have quite a few people.
Having worked at Bernheim and Makers and Corrusion, and definitely seeing, you know, how the Booker's plant runs. I mean, you have like this portfolio of knowledge of how facilities operate. And anybody who knows distilleries knows that Bernheim, you have to really figure that distillery out. Tell me, what is the big difference between operating Bernheim versus Maker's Mark, and what time of year does Maker's operate best, and what time of year does Bernheim operate best?
Fred, I think the big difference when you get into those distilleries, you know, the one of the things that, you know, when I was at Bernheim, it would really chat my ass when I'd hear people talk about, well, we got this craft distillery over here doing this or that. And I'm like, well, goddamn, we're a craft distillery. Well, no, you can't be. You guys do, you know, 1,000 barrels a day. Or, I mean, even more than that. 1,200, you know, 1,300 barrels a day, I believe, when I left. But the process is the same, right? You still have to put all the attention into the quality of the grains that come in. So you still got to have the same relationship with those farmers. You know, mashing, the science behind it, none of it changes. I think the big difference, Fred, is when you have an uh-oh in a plant like Bernheim, it's a big one because it impacts so much liquid.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, at Makers, you know, like the fermenters at Bernheim are 124,000 gallons. So you can yield about 350 barrels roughly per fermenter. Whereas, you know, our batch size is closer to 25 barrels. That's where, you know, your mistakes in a big facility get multiplied very, very, very quickly. So you have to make sure that you're really paying attention to the data, to the quality side of things. And that's the hardest thing. And, you know, distilleries are great until they're not. And what I mean by that is when you start seeing some upsets in the operation, maybe your yield's dropping a little bit, maybe you're picking up a musty note in the distillate and you're trying to figure out the problem with the distillery is there's no quick solution or fix to that, because, you know, when you look at mashing, fermentation is usually going to be a minimum of 3 days, and you got to distill it. So you might be 4 days in to figure out, you know, whether or not that tweak worked. But I just think your mistakes are magnified in the bigger distilleries. But as far as like the people and all that, all incredible. The automation's a little bit different, obviously, in those bigger facilities. So you got to make sure. I think that's the tough thing too, is not relying on all automation, because even though, you know, that screen might be showing you that valve is open and that pump is on, may not be. So it's literally, you got to make sure you're still in tune with the sights and literally the sounds of a distillery. I think if you talk to any distiller, the one thing that they will talk to you about that's very difficult to explain is that I can walk into a distillery, just like most people, not just master distillers, but people that work in distilleries, and within the first 10 seconds can kind of tell you how things are going just based on sound. So it's making sure you don't lose that. As far as time of year, I mean, we all make better whiskey this time of year, mainly because of the temperature, and, you know, your water quality is a little bit better just because the water's cooler. You're not, you know, you're always worried about whiskey production in the summertime, mainly because of the quality of the water. You know, if you get any algae blooms or anything like that with the warmer temperatures in a lake or stream, then that's exactly how you can get a musty note in that distillate.
Can you control your yeast more in the cool weather or warm versus warm?
It depends on the process. I mean, back in the day, I mean, that's literally why when you talk to how distilleries used to run, they would shut down all of summer. Like, they would literally start shutting things down probably in May, stay down through August, September, and then start back up, because they didn't have really the solutions and the engineering that we have today when it comes to whether it's chillers that help run the condensers so you can condense, you know, all the alcohol vapor back to liquid, or it's keeping your yeast at a low temperature. Because that's a big one. I mean, if your yeast, you know, if that temperature starts to climb in your yeast cooler at all, then you're going to be in trouble. Yeah. And you're probably going to kill your yeast, and then you're up shit creek. But with science, you know, with the way things that have evolved today, it's not as important, you know, as long as you have, it's more expensive, you know, in the summertime, your chillers have a larger load because the water coming in is a little bit warmer and there's things like that. But I think the takeaway on that though, Fred, is there's not a lot of differences. I would never, you know, the bigger guys are doing things very similar. I think they have to make sure that they don't lose sight of what we've all been accustomed to, which are the sights, sounds, and smells of a distillery. And as long as they're doing that, they should be in pretty good.
Well, you don't have to walk as many stairs at Maker's Mark
no,
as
you do, man. Bernheim. Yeah, I mean, it can be intimidating. I mean, you see, you know, we did that expansion project was the big project I did a little bit before I left, and they've got 17 124,000-gallon fermenters. Those are big ass fermenters.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you look when you're standing up on, you guys have seen it when you're standing up on the grating.
Yeah. And
you're
looking. Your phone in
yeah. There. Don't it's drop like, your phone and don't look down if you're scared of heights.
It's like every time I see those tanks, I'm like, why do people get so mad about limited releases? It's just another barrel of whiskey. There's 350 of them in here.
They're making more of them every day.
Well, yeah. And that, you know, that is the other interesting thing too about the larger distilleries is, you know, when you innovate, you're innovating big, because when you do an innovation batch, like for us, you know, if we're going to, you know, let's say we're going to do something different, maybe we do 10, you know, five fermenters. So it's a little over 100 barrels. Those guys, like, you can't, the minimum innovation you're probably going to do in big fermenters like that is 100 barrels easy.
Well, you got what you wanted. We ended off on like a scientific note.
Yeah. Yeah. I love talking to Denny because it's always... Like I said, no one can explain things like he does. Like everyone, a lot of people have the knowledge, but Denny is you're a great communicator. You're really, really great at like talking to us people who can barely read.
So. Well, just, I mean, you know, Fred, you spent a lot of time with us at Bernheim. He was even riding, you know, he was in the semi trucks with the grain haulers going back and forth to the farms. And
was he like, let me honk the horn. I want to honk the horn.
Well, when he first had reached out about, you know, just doing research and trying to become more familiar with distillers. Most people are, you know, they want 2 or 3 hours. Fred was like, no, I'll take 2 weeks if you got 2 weeks. Yeah. I mean, he was all in. So,
by the way, that riding in one of those trucks made me appreciate truck drivers. My God.
Oh my God.
It's painful to be in one of those.
Things. I want to say, thinking back on that, I might be wrong about this. I want to say you were scheduled to go, and then there was a big snowstorm, and it was like, Fred probably shouldn't be on the interstate with this guy when we've got a foot of snow on the ground. There was something I can't remember.
Yeah, there were a few things we had to work around, but it was, you know, getting to experience the distillery like that was, you know, and this was really before people were, you guys weren't even operating yet, and like before, like the media, kind of whiskey media was really humming.
Before OSHA violations and
all that stuff. Yeah. I just, man, that's...
He had his closed-toe shoes on.
I miss those days. Those are the days I cherish most of my career, is being in the distillery. And
You're welcome to come to Makers anytime.
Now you got to fit.
Well, when I go to Makers, it's like, you know, I'm just like, you know, can I just live here? You know?
Oh, no, it's one of the prettiest properties on the trail.
It truly is. So, Denny, thank you again for coming on the show today. It's a pleasure to have you. If there's a way that people can follow you, want to know more about you and about Makers, what's the best way to do it? Are you on TikTok yet?
No, not TikTok. I do have an Instagram account. I am like, I'm not social media ignorant, but I'm not very good. I do have an Instagram account. I couldn't even tell you what the call sign is, or do we call it that?
Is it a call sign? Handle or something?
Like, yeah, my handle.
It's Makers Mark 12-year-old.
Yeah. You're not going to see
Hashtag
a lot of activity
Mark 12.
From me on that.
He posts and ghost, you know, just.
Well, it's an interesting, I mean, you know, I think that's been honestly one of the toughest things as you've kind of come up in the industry and people are more interested and you're more visible in the public. Like I have a Facebook account, which according to my kids is, what the hell, you're an old man. I'm like, okay, I know I am. But it is that mix of family and friends and then people that are friending you. And I friend everybody. Like if you send me a friend request, I'm gonna, but it's a, That's a different one.
By the way, it's DP Potter.
If you is it? Okay, all right. Well, that's, damn, that was a tough one to remember.
That's inactive since.
I think it's active because I know people tag me and stuff, but yeah.
There you go. You get another 20 more requests to be verified after this goes live.
That's right. I'll check it.
Well, again, thank you for coming on the show today. It's always, we got to have you back on. We don't need to wait another 4 years to have you on. Yeah, so
we'll do it once a year.
We'll make it happen. Yeah. This is fun. Thank you again. So make sure you follow him or find him on Facebook. You can just go ahead and
we'll do that 14-hour podcast. Yeah, in Loretta. Yeah. And make our own
blend.
We could do that.
Oh, that'll be a long one. But make sure you follow Bourbon Pursuit wherever you get your podcasts, including YouTube. With that, cheers everybody, and we'll see you all next week.
We want Makers 12.